Welcome back to the program. Judging by most of the political discourse, reality television, tabloids, newspapers and magazines, TMZ, and some social networking, it might be pretty safe to argue that we are a nation of Philistines. Yet our guest, longtime social critic Carlin Romano, argues in his new book, America the Philosophical, that we are perhaps the most philosophical nation in history. How could the coarsening of our culture result in so much serious philosophy? We're going to talk about this with my guest, Carlin Romano. He's a critic at large of the Chronicle on Higher Education. For 25 years, he's been the literary critic for the Philadelphia Inquirer. He's a professor of philosophy and humanities. He's a former president of the National Book Critics Circle and was a finalist for the 2006 Pulitzer Prize in Criticism. It is my pleasure to welcome Carlin Romano to talk about his new book, America the Philosophical. Carlin Romano, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure, Jeff.
Great to have you here. One of the things that you talk about is that you kind of define philosophy as the practice of persuasion and the expanding practice of persuasion. It seems that in our society today there's less persuasion going on and more people becoming hardened in whatever it is that they believe.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I got hit by that question in one of my first bookstore presentations. You know, and it was a good question. It was, if you really think America is so philosophical, do you think people are changing their mind all the time? And I thought about it. This may say something about my media background. I thought about it for about 10 seconds, and I had an answer ready. So I guess that makes me a deep thinker. But a thought occurred to me. I realized if you really think about how things operate in America, okay, you know, people over 35, maybe make it 40, they probably don't change their minds that much. But I think if you really focus on people, say, between the ages of 8 and 25, I kind of came back to my own thesis. I think people probably change their minds more in this country. In other words, they go from whatever belief system they had, you know, as a child or mm-hmm. that they're taught by their family, and then change to something else because there's just so many belief systems available. We have so much free access to them. You know, it's possible to still wander into a bookstore or go somewhere on the net and start believing things that you never did before. And a lot of that is based on evidence, it's based on argument, it's based on, you know, a large contextual perspective. So, you know, that's one reason I do think we are that way. When I think comparatively with other countries and with other cultures over time, I kind of stick to my guns.
And it does seem all of that is indeed true within certain pockets in the country. You know, and I hate to put this in political terms, and I really don't want to, but for shorthand, it's true in blue states, maybe not so much in red states.
Well, I do think that's one of the standard observations, but I'm not that happy with that view. I mean, as a journalist, I've been around a lot over the years. I read a tremendous amount. I've met a lot of people, different states, different spheres, economically, religiously, and so on. I'm not sure that that's true. I do think that people are more open-minded than we give them credit for. And I feel my book is not right or left. Throughout it, I sometimes am tough on figures on the right. I'm sometimes tough on people on the left. But I responded to one person who raised a question about the Tea Party by saying, you know, a lot of those people became Tea Party types. They weren't born Tea Party types. I wasn't making a brief for the Tea Party or any of the beliefs, you know, people who call themselves that, you know, hold. But I think there's a fair amount of shifting there, too. When people become more radical on the right, it's sometimes because they've been persuaded by evidence and, of course, from another perspective, by a bill of goods.
And part of the strength of your argument is that you also argue that part of philosophy is an irreverence towards authority, and we certainly have plenty of that.
Absolutely. I probably differ here from a lot of people in the the punditocracy. One example I've used is that famous moment a few years ago when a congressman called out, "You lie," to Obama. And, you know, the reaction among a lot of opinion types was, oh, my God, just another further degradation of our public discourse and deliberation and so on. Now, I'm not claiming that, you know, someone yelling, "You lie," constitutes philosophy. But I do think those moments actually loosen up the culture. In other words, it's very important that Americans resist authority. And we're almost taught that our national mythos is to resist authority, to rebel, to have a revolution if things aren't the way we like it. So I think moments like that actually, you know, open up the possibility for other people, more thoughtful, more sustained in the way they present arguments, to do philosophy.
And with respect to the way people present arguments, one of the things that you talk about that's particularly interesting is this idea of blurred concepts, the idea that these arguments don't have to have absolute clarity, absolute sharp corners.
Absolutely right, he said. No. I use that phrase. It's a famous line out of the philosopher Wittgenstein that a blurred concept is still a concept. And in fact, the idea goes back to Aristotle that you shouldn't seek more precision with a concept or an area of life than what it can actually bear, what it deserves as it operates in culture. So I feel that way about the notion of philosophy and about a lot of other notions that we argue about. And you don't have to jump to extremes like nothing is true. There is no definition of a concept at all. You don't have to go that far, but we understand in life, most ordinary folks who are not specialized philosophers, that there's some give and take with concepts. So when I'm arguing for that and also for a type of philosophy that's not sort of syllogistic, lockstep argument that leads to certainty, I'm actually arguing for a view that was held by an ancient philosopher named Isocrates, not Socrates. Socrates with an I in front of his name, separate person, contemporary with Socrates. And to my view, his way of thinking about philosophy makes more sense to what we do in America than that of Socrates, who was kind of about absolute eternal verities. So one of the things I'm trying to do in the book, too, is suggest to people that, in a way, the whole history of philosophy is a little misconceived. Plato made Socrates the kind of god of philosophy. I'm suggesting we'd be smarter to go back to Isocrates.
Mm-hmm. What is the nexus then between that and science, which we often include in this discussion, in a more contemporary world where we look to science, for example, for precise answers?
Right. I'd say this, that science has to be put to the side somewhat when you're talking about philosophy, because philosophy is often dealing with issues that have not yet risen to the crystallized form in which science can treat them. But I would also say, and this is hardly original with me, but it's been around in the academic world for a long time, the very notion of science that is wonderfully precise at all times has been attacked now, you know, for decades. The figure I'd mention to your listeners, if they're not familiar with him, is someone named Thomas Kuhn, K-U-H-N. He wrote a book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, and he talked about the way paradigms of science change so much over time. You may remember the recent controversy about, you know, whether Einstein's theory of absolute speed of light could actually continue to be held based on some experiments that took place in mm-hmm. in Switzerland that seemed to undermine it. Okay, well, they found a flaw there, but it was interesting to read the reaction. Could Einstein be wrong? Well, the history of science is a history of being wrong as much as it is a history of being right. You go back to any time and you'll find various theses held supposedly through experimental results that turned out not to be true. So I have a great deal of respect for science, but I think when we consider it a discipline that really does give us absolute answers that last throughout time, we've seen that's not true.
And is that the same metric that we're trying to apply sometimes to philosophy? Are we looking for a kind of unified field theory of life in terms of philosophy?
Yeah, I think we are. I think that is the Socratic tradition. I mean, you can emphasize different things in the Socratic tradition, and a lot of philosophers do emphasize the questioning, the moving forward. But I refer to Socrates in my book as a kind of know-it-all who pretended to know nothing. If you read the dialogues, you do get a sense that he's moving toward, if not a pre-cooked answer, at least an answer that he believes is a lasting one that all should accept. And I question that.
Which raises the issue on the other extreme, can we look to comedy and satire, for example, as a kind of philosophy?
Absolutely. One of the things I also try to suggest in the book, that philosophy is not just a massive tome, maybe 1,000 pages, maybe 600, in a conventional book, often by a white male, and that is the only thing we can consider philosophy. I think it's possible to do philosophy through film. I think lots of comics, lots of commentators do a kind of philosophy. Again, I'm not saying every talk show host, every stand-up guy is a philosopher. It depends. But we've certainly recognized that we've had comics, for instance, who are sharp social critics. And I think because of the way we have seen philosophy conventionally, it's very difficult sometimes for people to flip their mind. Take an example like Bill Maher, mm-hmm. On his show, right? One moment he's arguing something that's philosophical about income inequality, say, and the next moment he's doing masturbation jokes. Do the masturbation jokes undermine what he's saying about income inequality? One of the other things I do in my book is to bring in what I call casual wise men. I have a little stretch about Hugh Hefner, for instance. Mm-hmm. I actually think he did operate as a philosopher in life, and not just because there are a lot of guys driving around with rabbit symbols on their rear view mirrors, but because he actually did make arguments. He wrote pieces, that he put together as the Playboy philosophy, and I think he had a tremendous effect on beliefs about sex in the country.
In that sense, is Lenny Bruce a philosopher?
I think you could argue so. I mean, for instance, if you had someone, I don't know if there is a book. I mean, when you look at academic libraries, you have to guess there probably is a book already. But if somebody came out with a book, Lenny Bruce, philosopher, and you started to turn the pages, I would bet a scholar could mine a lot of his routines. I mean, we know he was an important social critic. Tie together maybe some of the arguments he made more piecemeal in his stand-up routines and so on, and make a credible case.
Which raises the other question that you talk about in America the Philosophical, is the degree to which rigor is important or less important in philosophy.
Right. Well, I did something on Book TV the other day in Chicago, and my esteemed colleague, very good critic, named Julia Keller, she's the culture critic of the Chicago Tribune, she started to talk about rigor. And I'm not sure how this popped out of my mouth. I'm sure as a radio host, you're sometimes stunned by what pops out of a guest's mouth. But I suddenly said to her, take a rowboat out with rigor and imagination and see who you like better. Now, I then explained, I'm not against rigor, but it's kind of that Wittgensteinian, point again. Mm-hmm. Rigor is great where it's appropriate, but when it leads you to false rigor about things that are really a little bit less, more shapeless, a little more sloppy in life, then I think it not only gets in the way, but it creates tension.
What about the slippery slope argument, though, that if, in fact, we start taking this looser view about some things, that it then sort of carries on to things that are more important?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a danger of that, but it's a danger that we easily face by keeping up some standards. In other words, I don't think every delusional person on the street, unable to tie together two sentences, incoherent even when asking for money, is a philosopher. But neither do I think the only people we should call philosophers are people who walk around pronouncing syllogisms. I think, again, there's a warp and woof there that we can operate between. I do believe in argument. I do believe in presentation of evidence. I do think the evidence has to be connected to claims. It has to make some sense. And that reasonable people would need to be persuaded. But there's no exact point at which we can sort of firm up those standards. They may vary, for people. They may vary according to the subject. So I'm not for dumbing down all over the place. I don't think everybody's a philosopher. But I do think the activity of philosophy extends way beyond, the professional discipline of philosophy.
And one of the things that you talk a lot about that, in fact, sets the variation in those standards is diversity in our culture and how important that diversity is.
Yeah, I absolutely do feel that. I was sad to see about a week ago the Wall Street Journal
accused you of identity politics.
Well, you read it exactly.
Yeah.
I thought, here I write maybe 100, 50 pages or so about women philosophers, Native American philosophers, black philosophers, gay philosophers. That becomes a paragraph about identity politics. I don't talk about identity politics in my book. I talk about people, individual people who think. And in those cases, people who have in some ways been excluded from not just the philosophy profession, but the very notion of philosophy. I mean, it was not very long ago, and for some people, the time may still be now, when a woman just couldn't be a philosopher. You know, she was a child. Schopenhauer thought women were childish. So I do think that makes a difference, because as we found, I'm a longtime newspaperman, also. As we found in newspapers, you bring in different types of people, you get different types of stories. And I would say in philosophy, you bring in different types of people, you get different types of arguments, and also different problems.
Mm-hmm. What role, then, does popular culture play in shaping that diversity and in shaping philosophical ideas? And how much of a role should it play?
Well, I think it should play a big role. I mean, I'm a tremendous believer in both journalism and philosophy. Excuse me. And when I say journalism, I mean not just the doing of it, but the reading of it. One of the problems I have with areas of professional philosophy, and not every area, is that it doesn't take account of the world sufficiently. It doesn't deal with enough data, but in journalistic talk, facts, what's going on out there. And so, there's an area of standard official philosophy called epistemology, the theory of knowledge, which is often conducted with just a pocket full of examples and with really preposterous notions, one of which is, for instance, that we ordinary people don't know how to use the word know. You know, we need these guys basically in philosophy departments to explain to us what we're doing when we use the word know. In contrast, there are philosophers of art, I think this is a strong area of standard philosophy, who are almost braggarts about knowing everything about art back to the pre-Columbians, every culture and so on, and they adjust their claims, accordingly, so their work is more convincing. I think, if you're going to talk about something like, for instance, laughter or comedy, which some philosophers talk about, you've got to be following what people do in comedy. You have to understand it. You're going to talk about politics and do political philosophy. You've got to use up-to-date examples, cases like China, which is not communist in a traditional way. It's not capitalist in a traditional way. So I think popular culture, entertainment, film, all of these things, you need to be literate in those areas if you're going to start forming generalizations about cultural concepts.
What role, then, is there for the academy and for universities in talking about and dealing with philosophy?
Well, I still think the academy plays an excellent role. One of the things that the academy does, for instance, is to preserve culture generation to generation, and traditionally to preserve a kind of serious culture. So one argument I make in the book, and I've made in several presentations because the question has come up, is, well, how can you consider this a philosophical culture when we have so much dreck, so much stuff, that is not serious, that's always in our face, celebrity gossip, TMZ, what did Lindsay Lohan do yesterday, And my reaction is, all this shall pass. If you look at that stuff decades ago, a lot of it has disappeared. At one point in the book, I'm talking about Mr. T and the Lambada and things like that. I have nothing against Mr. T or the Lambada, but certain things that are in our faces and in our conversations a lot in one decade don't last, in part because the academy, once those things have vanished from the popular culture, doesn't think they were important enough to preserve. So I think the academy provides that. And then there's the enormous erudition that scholars really have, where they can come to a subject and bring a lot to bear. I would just say this, as a book editor for a long time who had to assign book reviews, I was always looking for people who were not captives of the book in front of them, who would just report a little bit and then throw in an opinion. A scholar brings all sorts of erudition from other books on the same subject, from counter, theorists and so on, and that really gives you a good context for any item of culture. So I don't think the Academy is going to fade, and I think it has a good role to play in all this.
And part of what's interesting in terms of the stuff out of popular culture is what will last and what won't. As you say, most of it is pretty disposable, but you look at something like Hugh Hefner that you mentioned earlier, and that might have been dismissed as disposable at the time, but you argue that it's lasted, that it's had an impact.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. He began in the 50s, right? So it's quite a while later. I don't think anybody could dispute that common notions about sexuality in the United States have changed tremendously. I remember a book years ago that I read and reviewed called The Repeal of Reticence. And it was about this change in the attitude about sexuality. I mean, you know, years ago, what you could say on radio, what you could say on TV, what you could show in a movie, all very different. I'm not claiming that Hugh Hefner did this as a revolutionary in the sense that Karl Marx, you know, communicated, you know, Marxism, you know, to Europe and so on. But what I am saying is that those things make a difference. In fact, one of my views is that simply having somebody in a society who to some degree seriously articulates a way of thinking, and I would say Hefner fits that, has a lot to do with people changing their minds, because not everybody can do that kind of articulation. If they see it, they can then associate themselves with it, and that makes it easier, you know, to hold those beliefs. You know, so I've joked to people, I've got a photo of Hefner in the book in which he actually looks like Bertrand Russell, you know, the felt hat, pipe, and all of that. But that's not my only, you know, argument. I think that having the kind of outreach that he did when, you know, Playboy was selling millions and millions and was on TV and had all the clubs and so on, it made a difference to the ordinary person's ability to be, you know, a little freer in sex.
And the flip side of that is that you're pretty tough on Alan Bloom, for example.
Alan Bloom seems to me to have some, you know, pros and cons. And this also comes back to the notion of, you know, the ephemera and transience of lots of views. So Alan Bloom, for instance, you know, he hated rock music. He hated the music of the kids that he taught around the time that book came out. Well, you know, what do we think of the Rolling Stones now? You know, they're classic, right? They're mm-hmm. not sort of cutting edge or offensive or so on. So a lot of that stuff, I think, was a little bit personal and maybe nonsensical. The part that I like about the closing of The American Mind was just his kind of almost innocent love for great books and the idea that great books could set you on a path to thinking about truly serious ideas in life. My position would be, you know, you can come to those things without reading Plato or Aristotle, but it's true. You can also come to them by showing a concern for great books that don't get much airtime, you know, in our society. So I have a bit of affection, you know, for what Alan Bloom was mm-hmm. trying to do. But I certainly don't agree with the implication of his title, The Closing of the American Mind. I think the American mind is tremendously open.
And should there be a difference, is there a difference between private debate on these things and public discourse about philosophy and about the culture?
Well, I suppose so. I mean, you know, if you imagine all the private conversations that are going on in this country, you know, some of them would be perhaps indecipherable by others. People speak in their code languages. People who are interested in any belief system start acquiring a kind of nomenclature in which they operate. And, of course, it would be great if our public discussion was pressured a little bit by that. I mean, a type of objection which I, you know, expect to the book is, well, come on, really, think about American, you know, media conversation, public conversation, you know, what's on radio shows, what's on TV shows, and so on. Isn't it really between the 40-yard line and the 40-yard line? I mean, do we allow extreme opinions, you know, on? So I guess my response to that would be, if we include all the private conversations going on, the things that are a little too kinky or too extreme to get on, say, mainstream, you know, TV or radio, then we have a tremendously philosophical culture. If we then think about public deliberation through the media, I would agree it could be broader. I would like to see people in media be braver, you know, and sort of, you know, let on, not the kooks, but voices that we don't hear all the time. I don't know about you, but, you know, when I'm in a hotel room and I turn on, you know, the TV and I see the same voices all the time talking about Obama versus Romney or whatever, I get bored.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear some different voices, not the same, you know, cliche speak that particularly people in the Beltway put out.
Carlin Romano. The book is America the Philosophical. Carlin, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, great questions, Jeff. Thanks.
Thank you.